Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, AMD Radeon 7. The benchmarks are impressive. Dell's massive new 49-inch monitor, NVIDIA DLSS, another 50% bump in RTX performance. Find out. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 503, recorded on February 7th, 2019. AMD Radeon 7, benchmarked and reviewed. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Check your online activity today for 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/twitch. And by Helm. Take back your email and your own data with Helm, a secure personal server that enables you to own your online identity. For a limited time, save $50 off the Helm personal server by visiting thehelm.com/twitch. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most engaging, most delightful, most charming, most informative, and gosh darn it, the most value-oriented hardware coverage available online. Except, of course, when we decide to spend all the money. I'm Patrick Norton, joined by PCPer's very own Sebastian Peak. How's it going, man?
Good. How are you doing?
I am apparently full of mirth and good cheer.
And so I think you slept last night, I take it.
And more than I expected to.
Okay. I was up till 5 myself finishing my review and proofing it. And just, you know, I got about 3 or 4 hours of sleep, though. It's okay.
Did the baby sleep through the night while you were finishing the review?
Mostly. He's been sick. So that was the thing. I'm managing a fever and checking on him. And he's tossing and turning. He woke up at, like, you know, shortly after I did, always. So.
Oh. Like, yeah, quiet time. Going to finish this up. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So we should talk about this, right? AMD Radeon 7 announced at CES. Kind of a surprise for me that we were – I was thinking we would get hardcore Ryzen, you know, 3000 news and maybe some light. This is the future of the AMD GPU platform. I had it completely backwards. There was a whole lot of AMD 7 and the mention of 7 nanometer. And anywhere Dr. Su could mention 7, especially in reference to nanometer and process, just to kind of dig a fork, I think, in Intel and probably NVIDIA. Certainly based on some of the reactions we saw at NVIDIA, not something they expected to be announced at CES. And, you know, not that I don't love the 2060, but this was a pretty big announcement compared to the 2060. I didn't expect cards to show up this fast. Was this kind of a surprise, or did you leave with a card at CES, or can you talk about any of this? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the card is behind me. They shipped these out, like all the reviewers' kits that came on these nice acrylic stands with LED lighting were shipped out after the fact. I didn't have mine until about a week before this release, I think. Uh-huh. And so it's kind of a blur. I don't really remember days anymore. But the, yeah, like you said, it was a surprise. I was expecting, we were hearing rumors about new processors. We were thinking it was going to be Zen 2, like Ryzen 3000 series CPUs. And I was like, to the point where I was creating tables based on like leaked specs so I could have stuff ready for the news post. And I'm watching the keynote and then this comes out. So, and Lisa was talking about the move to 7 nanometer, and I'm like wondering, is this like new graphics architecture? What is going on here? And you know, the thing that we maybe would have expected is maybe like a high end graphics solution coming later on, and we would see the CPUs first. But it's obviously, like you said, it's flip flop. Like the opposite is what happened here.
Right.
But this is still a really interesting product. Like architecturally, for those that follow such things, this is not breaking new ground. There's not a bunch of new graphical features, that sort of thing. What this is optimized, refined, and as they say, supercharged Vega. So the Vega 10 core was the thing that powered their previous high-end graphics, the RX Vega 64, and like workstation graphics like the Radeon Frontier Edition. And what Radeon 7 is it's basically the consumer version of, they have a line of products called Instinct, the Radeon Instinct products of like their workstation compute cards. So this is based on the same Vega 20 core found in the Instinct MI50 workstation card. So what this is, actually fewer compute units are enabled on this versus Vega 64, which surprised me at the beginning. So you have fewer stream processors, 3,840 enabled versus the full 4,096. Mm-hmm. And so at the outset, just looking over the specs, I'm thinking, is it just clocks? So the move down to 7 nanometer would allow them to shrink the die. It shrunk considerably from 495 millimeters squared down to 331 millimeters squared. And the extra space on that interposer on this chip is now filled with two additional stacks of 4 gigabytes of HBM2 memory, the high bandwidth memory.
Whoa.
And that was the big change, because when you add stacks of HBM2 on this architecture, they're adding memory controllers. So it went from 2 memory controllers to 4 memory controllers, which literally doubles the memory bandwidth. And then they actually boosted the memory speed as well. So slightly faster memory. So we go from a little under 500 gigabytes per second total bandwidth with Vega 64 to a terabyte of memory bandwidth with Vega, or with Vega 20 and, of course, the Radeon 7. So just...
Wow.
If there was any bottleneck at all to Vega before, I can imagine that it's got to be gone. So not only do you have just ridiculous amounts of bandwidth, but you have more graphics memory, more frame buffer than we've ever seen from a consumer graphics card at 16 gigabytes. So just all sorts of questions about what the performance would be like. Obviously, AMD allowed reviewers to sort of tease the card, show pictures of the card, unbox the card back on the 4th, but we couldn't share any performance numbers until today. And so I spent a day with the card at 2560 by 1440, and I spent a day with it running 4K tests. And basically right off the bat, what I was seeing was performance right in between an RTX 2070 and an RTX 2080, with the 2080 still having a pretty healthy lead with synthetic benchmarks anyway. And as I moved on to gaming, I thought, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that would explain some of the NVIDIA reaction at CES, which a friend of mine referred to as like, wow, that was quite a tantrum. One of the public postings that came out. That's a huge jump in terms of AMD performance. Now, you know, this isn't an inexpensive card, but neither are the 2070 or the 2080. And it's like in one fell product jump, they've gone from sort of middle of the pack to awfully close to the fastest card you can buy today. That's a huge jump.
I mean, if you look at, obviously, I didn't do any testing with the 2080 Ti because that's just in another like stratosphere of cost.
Sure.
At $1,000. The RTX 2080 and this Radeon 7 are both $699 cards. And while AMD is offsetting the cost, as GPU makers will do with a game bundle, and there are three like top tier games that's worth $180 to kind of subsidize that price, there is absolutely still a bit of a pricing issue with this. If you're just looking at the raw performance, and if you read the review and go through all the charts, what you'll see is for AMD optimized games, like Far Cry 5, like Ashes of the Singularity Escalation, this is right up there trading blows with the 2080. Like in Far Cry 5, like one of my tests, I think I had it out on top. It depends on resolution. Like 4K, it was like in second place, or, you know, 1440, it might be in first versus second. But in those games, it's right up there. So you have to think like a certain amount of its potential performance is going to be how well optimized the software is to take advantage of this particular kind of hardware. Like, this is unusual hardware that, you know, it's having this much memory and having this much memory bandwidth, this is significantly different from how you could handle things like high resolution textures and higher resolutions and things. So there is more room to push this card than I was even able to test, even at 4K, because my 4K testing is at pretty modest settings, like standard normal preset settings, nothing high. And it was still a little bit better overall at 4K than it was at 1440. So then I have to wonder, like, what if I enable all like optional HD textures, push the resolution even higher? NVIDIA and AMD both have this technology. DSR is what it's called on the NVIDIA side, and ASR, I think, on the AMD side. It's basically oversampling. Like, you render off screen at a higher resolution than your monitor can actually handle, and then it's basically downsampled at the display engine level to your monitor, so you end up with like an entire screen anti-aliasing sort of effect. It's basically what Apple does with their Retina displays on Macs. So you can do that with these graphics cards in certain supported games, but you run into a wall with video memory very fast. So that's one of the things that they had talked about, was you can do that. You can do dynamic resolution and actually avoid hitting the 8 gigabyte wall that you would get with the NVIDIA card at the same price. So they're kind of looking for ways, it seems, on the gaming side to make use of this much frame buffer, which is just an unprecedented amount of memory, like I said. Mm-hmm. But at some point, you're more constrained by the power of the GPU than you are the amount of memory that you have. And that's when the whole content creation side of this really makes that amount of memory more interesting. So while the gaming picture is kind of like it's right in between a 2070 and a 2080, depending on whether the game is optimized for AMD or not, the content creation side is just, it's clear. Like, this for OpenCL compute is significantly faster than what we saw with Vega 64. And that's a combination of the optimizations, obviously the increased memory bandwidth, but also this is so much more aggressively clocked than what we saw with Vega 64. Like, this has a peak frequency of 1800 megahertz, depending on the workload, and a boost clock speed of 1750. And the cooler on this card, this triple fan cooler, is extremely efficient. It favors thermals over noise, certainly. It's not a really loud card because it's not a blower style card, but it still moves a lot of air and you can hear it. And my testing, I never saw any temperature over 60 degrees at load. So you have a lot of headroom. And they were showing gains, like the gains in Luxmark, like the Luxball HDR rendering test. Huge, huge gains, and, you know, appreciable, like significant gains in other tests as well. And they were using Adobe Creative Cloud, like Premiere, as an example, how you could edit 8K video where you're easily creating situations where you might eclipse 8, 10, 11 gigabytes of video memory. And this significantly speeds up the process because you're not running out of RAM while you're rendering. So on the workstation side, this is a very interesting product because you're essentially getting a consumer version of the Instinct MI50, which is a $1,000 card. The only real difference is certain features are disabled. And actually, of interest, that MI50 and MI60, based on the Vega 20 core, Vega 20 is actually a PCI Express 4 platform. So Instinct is PCI Express 4.0. And this is only like 3.0 enabled. I don't know how much more benefit you might get from a move up to PCI Gen 4, but that's one difference. And obviously, you don't lack professional drivers for this, and they have reduced the FP64, like the double precision performance of this. So for those workstation workflows that require the use of ECC memory and double precision compute, you're getting a reduced amount with this. Although actually, the amount that they settled on, which didn't even happen until I think yesterday or today, is more than four times what it was originally going to be. It was going to be like a 16th of full precision, and now it's up to like a quarter. So still very, across the board, excellent compute numbers, and certainly this could be used to accelerate, you know, video editing and rendering, in addition to being right in the conversation with some of the fastest gaming graphics cards you can buy. And really the only issue is price for from a gaming standpoint, because the 2080 is $699, the 2070 is $499. The performance of this card is right between those on average. Mm-hmm. And the price is not. So if this was $599, I'd be having the same conversation I had about the RTX 2060, where I'm like, this is priced exactly where it should be relative to its performance, and this is slightly above that. But I mean, I understand some of the reasoning. Obviously, they'd like to make money. I would hope they're making money on this product. But this is a lot of memory. This is a lot of HBM2, and this is basically I would imagine in the move to 7 nanometer, because it is so young. Like, they have not been on 7 nanometer for very long. This is their first GPU product, Vega 20. And a member of our staff, Josh, who is much more in tune with processor and graphics architecture than I am, he referred to this kind of as like a pipe cleaner. Like, when they go to a new process, they will use an existing architecture to kind of work out the bugs and move, like, to get to a point where they have higher yields, and they learn as they go. So the next architecture will be the one that's like completely different, and we will have like a new set of graphics features and things. So right now what we essentially have, like AMD had said, is this is basically supercharged Vega. It's the same core architecture, but less latency, higher bandwidth, much more aggressive clock speeds enabled by the move to 7 nanometer within the same board power limit. Like, this is still a 300 watt card. This is still going to require 2 8-pin connectors and a beefy power supply, but it's got the cooling power to keep this well within thermal limits with the stock cooler. And we have not heard of any like third party designs or anything yet. This is the card. And then my, like, the final point, I guess, is just availability, where what I'm kind of seeing today as I poke around the internet is there's really not availability for this card yet. So we will see. I don't think this was a paper launch, but I'm not sure where stock is currently.
But when we're looking at this, let's take the sort of content creators thing and put that to the side for a second, because that's a very, very specific market. I'd love to see some, you know, Premiere and Photoshop specific numbers on this card. But when we look at this, like, you know, like you said, right, the 2080 is a little bit more. It offers ray tracing. Ray tracing may be getting a little more useful. We'll talk about that in a second. But it seems like for sort of the beginning of the high end or the high mid gamer, and it amuses me because when we look at the comments to articles, either the 2060 is supposed to be a $200 card, or the 2070 is a mid level card. You know, despite the fact that it's currently priced a lot more expensive, which is something I find odd. But it's really flirting with 2080 performance on a lot of stuff for $100 less. If there's price elasticity in this card, if they can drop the price in the AMD Radeon 7, I feel like we will hear screaming from the NVIDIA campus.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If this had come out with a really aggressive price, and historically, I think a lot of gamers have... They see Radeon cards as the price performance leader, where you might be able to spend more money and get more performance with NVIDIA, where NVIDIA, you know, let's face it, for the last couple generations have had the lead in graphics performance. But you were paying for it. And on the AMD side, like, think about just a few months ago when RX 480 was supplanted by 580. We also have a higher clocked 590 part. But we're still talking about graphics cards that are in the $200 to kind of $220 range, that have 8 gigabytes of memory, that have enough power to play games with high settings at 1080, which is by far the most popular screen resolution. And you can even bump things up to 1440 if you want to. And that's great. Like, that's enough for a lot of people. And this high-end graphics card segment has been getting more and more expensive over time, where cards have gone from $400, $450, $500, and then the RTX 2080 launches at $699.
Right.
And it was hard to find cards at that price level where, you know, board partners, they have their own versions, factory overclocked versions. We were seeing things in the $700, $750 range. So for AMD to come out with a brand new graphics card, I think there's probably an expectation that it will be very price competitive. But I think for various reasons, they have decided to compete directly against at least the price point of the 2080. And that's where this might be thought of as a little bit of a disappointing launch, because it's not matching the 2080 in every test. Mm-hmm. And you're not saving any money. And then, of course, NVIDIA can make the argument, well, and you're not getting ray tracing.
Wow.
I actually asked AMD about this during our briefing, because obviously a DirectX offers support, or will be offering support for their version of ray tracing. And this has a lot of compute capability, though no dedicated ray tracing cores like the Tensor cores and the RTX products. And that was something that they weren't really answering, but basically said, you know, well, the compute power is there. So that's something that we could see implemented in this later to be more competitive. But I know we'll be talking shortly about NVIDIA's proprietary method of boosting ray tracing performance. And that's something that is exclusive to them, like RTX and DLSS are NVIDIA technologies. So it's, I wish it was more of like that exciting, like this is so much for the price. And now it's more of a thoughtful, like, oh, do I really need the content creation stuff? And if I'm just literally buying at a price point, like if I can spend $700 on a graphics card and I'm a gamer, I would have a hard time choosing this one over the RTX 2080 at the same price.
Right.
So,
and that makes sense. No, I was going to say it makes sense when you're looking at this, because I was looking at, I have a 1070. I was thinking about buying another 1070 because, you know, they're starting to show up super, super cheap. I know somebody that's getting rid of a pile of graphics cards that's bigger than my Husky. And, but I'm looking at that, and you start digging into SLI performance, and you know the numbers, depending on the optimization of the driver in the game for SLI, can be anywhere from, like, you will see, for all intents and purposes, no gain with your second card, to right. a 90% gain in performance. And you know, looking at, you know, one of the things you kind of repeated, especially with Shadow of the Tomb Raider and a couple other games, was, you know, traditionally this game has performed better on, you know, NVIDIA. And when you look at, you know, will AMD start spending the kind of money it takes to get, you know, or because I generally assume that either because of development partnerships or because they flat out, you know, spend the money to optimize the driver for the games, that's one of the biggest challenges for AMD if they want to fight on the gaming side, is they are going to have to, you know, pay a lot of money and shake a lot of hands and kiss a lot of posteriors so that their drivers are optimized as well and as often as NVIDIA drivers. And it's interesting to look at that, because, you know, we've talked about it with several games over the past few years where the performance bumps have been astonishing based on just upgrading, or I should say, I should probably also look at the right camera, based on just upgrading or optimizing the driver. And I think that's a big challenge for AMD. And that also, to me, would explain a lot of why at CES it was very content creator, content creator, content creator, where normally you would think, like, okay, I'm going to need a Quadro and it's going to be incredibly expensive if I want to be a professional content creator. And now they're like, look at all this power. Look at all this bandwidth. And that, to me, is really exciting when you're doing stuff like crazy stuff in Premiere. Again, haven't seen benchmarks. Going to look around for those. But it's an interesting card at an interesting place. Most people can't really take advantage of a 1080, much less a 2070 on their monitors. So,
yeah.
You know, do I want one? Absolutely. Do I need one? Probably not. You know, it's
it's unfortunate that things cost money, you know? Like they have to sell this for some price or other, and it has to make sense from a business standpoint. And if this was a different price, it would be a different story. Like it's still a great product. Like this is a great card. It has tremendous I can't believe how much they've gotten out of the same architecture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They go to a smaller process node. They increase clock frequencies. They double the memory and memory bandwidth, and it just flies. But the pricing, you know, changes the conversation, which is unfortunate.
Right. No, it's tough. I mean, as somebody who runs an ultra-wide monitor, it's like 3440 by 1440. I definitely, you know, I can, when I start turning settings up, I can strain my 1070, but it takes some work. And, oh, gosh, you know, this probably is as good a point as any to talk about the news that came from NVIDIA this week, which ray tracing, of course, is the big focus of the announcement of the 20 series cards. And now I'm just going to read the title that on Darren Allen's article over on TechRadar. NVIDIA boasts of DLSS boosting GeForce RTX frame rates by up to 50%. So if you have forgotten since last fall when all the deep conversations went around the next generation GPUs. So we're talking about deep learning super sampling. Yeah. And at some level, I look at this and I think, is this caching, like pre-caching work? But it's you know, looking at Port Royal, which is a ray tracing benchmark that basically is for GeForce RTX cards, right? Because there are no other, you know, ray tracing cards at the consumer level at this point. You know, there's you know, NVIDIA is basically claiming, again, benchmarks from companies, grain of salt, mini, take with, you know, analysis. But they're talking about like 50% bumps in performance across all the GeForce RTX GPUs. And this is huge, right? Because they released the cards, or I should say, they released the cards. And then finally, there was a video game, Battlefield 5, to test with the cards. And the experience with that was initially incredibly underwhelming. Then 2 or 3 weeks later, at the beginning of December, they released the driver update, which included the updates for RTX and Battlefield 5. And all of a sudden, it went from unplayable frame rates to playable frame rates. Disappointing frame rates, I think, compared to the, you know, game running in a standard 3D accelerated mode, And also because in a game that when you're moving fast, you maybe don't have as much time to enjoy the effects of ray tracing, or ray tracing is not as noticeable. And now they're talking about, you know, another 50% gain in performance, which will make would make RTX gaming much more possible or practical on the RTX cards. Are you curious about this? I mean, you know, we've seen a lot of side-by-sides of DLSS versus non-DLSS graphics where, you know, everything looks super clean and super sharp and super detailed and like it was rendered by the gods. You know, There's this benchmark. There's Final Fantasy 15. DLSS is going to show up in Battlefield 5. It's going to show up in Shadow of the Tomb Raider, Anthem. Right. I want to say Metro Exodus, and of course Anthro and Metro Exodus haven't been released yet. This seems like a really hard transition compared to, you know, DX10 to DX11, DX11 to DX12. This almost seems like the bad old early days of 3D where you could buy a GPU and it may or may not work for the majority of games in a year, depending on whether or not they kind of won the 3D wars. I mean, do you feel comfortable at this point that AMD will do, that RTX is the future and AMD will offer something compatible? Or is this always going to be an NVIDIA thing?
I feel like this will be an NVIDIA thing just because of how they're approaching it. And more so DLSS, because there will be not open necessarily, but there will be DirectX standards. Like DXR will enable people to have ray tracing on any GPU platform.
Right.
That's just not ready yet. But DLSS, to me, is very interesting. I've been doing as much reading as I can about it. But of course, and I'll just quote this, The specific details and method of training is NVIDIA's trade secret, since DLSS is a proprietary technology. So the more you try to read, and I'm referencing the 3D Mark technical guide, which was just updated a few days ago. And if you download this PDF and scroll all the way to like page 152, I think is where the actual talk about DLSS begins, they have a little bit more in-depth of an explanation of what it is than NVIDIA has provided yet.
Right.
But it goes a little bit further than I think what it was initially understood to be. There was some, I don't know if the word suspicion is the right one, but there was speculation that DLSS is doing more than just training a neural network to recognize what an aliased image looks like versus an anti-aliased image, and then is able to leverage this. It's not pre-rendering, but they've trained a neural network to look at, like, here's a frame with, here's a frame without, and have it make decisions about like the edges of an image or the color that should be in a given, you know, pixel of an image. And then they do all this heavy lifting on their side with their computers, and then they give all of this data to the game developer, and they put this data into their driver. So the two have to work together. It has to be a game that supports it, and it has to be enabled in the driver. And then you can have this sort of secret sauce work its magic. But one of the things that seemed apparent was, if you're getting a boost of like 50%, I think there is a little bit of a misconception that DLSS is just a way for AI and deep learning to replace anti-aliasing, like TAA is what it's directly compared to. And temporal anti-aliasing and DLSS are very, very different, because yes, a function of DLSS is an anti-aliased image without the huge performance impact. But what's actually happening, and this is where I, you know, it's on page 154, if you download this document, resolution with DLSS on. So internally, your graphics card with DLSS enabled is rendering the scene at a much lower resolution. The actual 3D acceleration is happening at a different resolution, and there's a little chart here. So if you're outputting at 1080p, internally, it's actually only rendering the game at 1440 by 810. So it's about a 25% reduction. That's like 0.75 times 1920 by 1080. And that is where your performance boost comes from. Now, it still looks good because of all the work they've done training the network so that the output looks smooth, the colors are in the right place, and it essentially is creating the higher resolution as its output, but internally it's only rendering at a lower resolution. And this goes down the higher you go in resolution. The 4K output resolution is actually only rendered at 2560 by 1440, which is only 67% of the full resolution, down from 75. So the result, and I saw them side by side at CES, and what we've seen so far with this Port Royal benchmark, it looks great. If you zoom in and freeze frame, you can point out little artifacts in the Port Royal benchmark that kind of show that this was actually rendered at a little bit lower resolution in certain spots. But that's kind of the interesting thing. It's, you know, greater performance because you're outputting at a resolution that your GPU did not actually have to do. So, you know, it's far easier on a graphics card to do 2560 by 1440 than it is to do 4K. And
right.
That's where a card like the RTX 2060, which they've targeted at 1440 gaming performance, yeah, it's an RTX card. That doesn't make any sense. It's not powerful enough to run ray tracing. Look at these frame rates. Well, turn on DLSS. Now that 2560 game is actually being rendered at 1080 internally. Output at 1440 without a performance penalty. So, but that's where the proprietary nature of this is. Like, NVIDIA is not just going, maybe they could sell time in their like huge, you know, neural network to other, they're not going to. I mean, they work with the game developers, and this is their proprietary technology. This is the selling point of RTX cards, I think, going forward will be, hey, look, right. Still the same frame rate. Now looks amazing with these ray traced effects that make everything look so much more natural. And, you know, reflections and water just look so much more real. And now it's not like, you know, half the frame rate. So
that's a big plus. Not half the frame rate, I think, is a selling point for gaming. So we should take a moment to thank our sponsor this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, brought to you by ExpressVPN. I have friends who are pen testers, who are hackers, who work in security, who work in wireless security. And if you want to watch a super awesome facial expression that looks like somebody just got a big old huff of castor oil, talk about using the Wi-Fi in an airport, the public Wi-Fi in a hotel or an airport. And there's nothing wrong with public Wi-Fi. There's nothing wrong with, crawling up next to a sick person and having them sneeze on you, right? This metaphor is odd, but it's kind of dangerous. If you don't want to be sick, you don't hang in, you don't rub yourself up against a sick person. And if you don't want to get hacked, you don't run on public Wi-Fi unless you have a VPN, right? You want to protect your computer. You want to protect your information. You want to protect your security. You run a VPN, a virtual private network. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. You get the information you need off the internet. The internet doesn't know who you are or where you are, so you can safely surf on public Wi-Fi. You can basically get your information. You can use your website. You can connect to your bank. You can go shopping on Amazon without panicking because you think you might be getting snooped on by that guy over there with the giant muffin and the big computer next to his empty cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. You don't want your personal data stolen. That's why you run a VPN. ExpressVPN, the number one VPN service rated by TechRadar, comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Cost is cheap, less than $7 a month. Think about rebuilding your life online versus just running a VPN for safety. Or if you just don't want your ISP at home to know what you're doing, you run a VPN. If they tend to throttle things that you think you have a right to run, use a VPN. It's cheap, less than $7 a month. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package at expressvpn.com/twitch. That's expressvpn.com/TWICH for 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/twitch. To learn more, we want to thank ExpressVPN for the support of This Week in Computer Hardware. I love large monitors, and ultra wide monitors make me happy. I got a U3415W on my desktop, and it's changed the way I use a computer to the point where I still spend a lot of time on laptops. But about every other time I'm doing something on a laptop, I wish I had that big wide expanse of real estate that I can have my curved monitor on my desktop so I can do more things more efficiently. And if you'd asked me a couple of weeks ago what the biggest challenge of 2019 was, I would have told you CES, until the box for Dell's Ultra Sharp 49 curved monitor showed up. Yeah, that's the monitor box. Monitor itself.
that's not small.
No. No, it was crazy. It's 49 inches diagonally. It's literally like 4 feet wide horizontally. It's wider than the desk I normally use at home by several inches, as in I cannot center it on that desk without moving the desk away from the wall. It is almost as wide as my kitchen table, which is not a small kitchen table. And that was interesting for me because normally I'm not a huge fan of ultra-wide monitors with a very, very tight radius. And you see that a lot, especially on gaming monitors. And when you look at the specs for a monitor, you usually see something like 3800R, 2700R. And that is the curvature of the monitor is defined by the radius of a circle in millimeters. So what's interesting about this 49-inch monitor is it has the exact same curve as the 34-inch monitor, I should say, because it's not 35, the 34-inch monitor on my desktop. And the U34 is pretty much perfect. And if you, for me, if you tighten the curve, it's cool for gaming. Or if you decrease the radius and therefore make the curve sharper, it's nice for gaming. But I find it really irritating when I'm doing things like running spreadsheets or in Photoshop, because all of a sudden straight lines seem kind of bent. And you get used to that, but it still irritates me. You know, my 3415 is fairly shallow, and this has the same fairly shallow radius. So imagine if you've got a circle with a radius of 12.4 feet or a circle that is 24.8 feet across. And that's how sort of that's a big kind of shallow circle. And so using this monitor gave me kind of a tennis match feel, you know, not so much for video gaming, like firing up Rocket League, it didn't really bother me. It was just more detail to the left and right of where I was focusing. But on stuff where you needed to pay attention to the corners, for example, if you put a giant spreadsheet up and you needed to read information up at, you know, the top column in the upper left-hand corner, you know, sort of column A, row one, you would find yourself like thinking, I might need binoculars. I may need to lean closer. Should I grab the monitor and twist it towards me? Now, as you see the video, if you're watching the video right now, there's a bunch of B-roll from Dell and some of the classic applications where you've got a sysadmin where they have a bunch of meters running in the background or in the far left and far right. Or if you are in, you know, the Wall Street mode, where Wall Street, they used to have like six monitors in every desktop. And now they can use, you know, individual windows inside of a single monitor. So if you have lots of information where it's like, okay, I don't really pay attention to this box full of graphics over here unless one of those rows turns red, and in which case I need to look over that way or pull the thing down. This is a pretty perfect monitor for that because it has a huge amount of information. It can convey a tremendous amount of information. But if you want to pay attention to everything, you really need to put everything in sort of the center third or the sort of the center half of the monitor, because it's kind of hard to look that far left and that far right. And it starts to just be very, very distant from where you are seated. Now, it's probably more problematic for me now as an adult later in life because I need to use reading glasses. But it might be problematic if you're wearing glasses at all. It's 32x9. The actual pixel density seems really low at 109 pixels per inch. It's 5120 by 1440, but that's actually not bad for a monitor this big. I wasn't, you know, sitting here looking at sort of discrete chunks of color thinking, gosh, I really wish this was a Retina display. But when you look at a lot of 49-inch monitors that are dedicated for gaming, you'll find out that they are a much lower resolution. For example, Samsung's CHG90 is running at 3840 by 1080. But it also offers a considerably higher frame rate. You know, this Dell monitor runs 60 frames per second, or I should say 60 hertz, when something like that Samsung CHG90 offers 144 hertz, which is a little easier to hit because it also has a considerably smaller number of pixels. Didn't see much in the way of hot spotting. The backlighting seemed pretty consistent for a monitor of this size. And, you know, gaming at 5120 by 1440 at 60 hertz, just fine on a GTX 1070. I think if you were, you know, using more taxing games and something like Rocket League, you may want to upgrade your GPU. There's a lot of things I like about this monitor because I like big monitors that allow you to look at a lot of stuff. But this was so big that I found myself pulling. You know, with video games, it wasn't too bad. I wasn't playing a lot of first-person shooter stuff where you have to pay a lot of attention to the corners. But, you know, in terms of, for example, using a spreadsheet, I really needed to take great, you know, sort of, I couldn't use the far left or the far right side of the spreadsheet. I had to pull the spreadsheet into the center of the monitor to not feel like I was watching a tennis match or reaching for a pair of binoculars to see the far corners. You know, I like ultra wides. I think this is about as big an ultra wide as anybody can use on a normal desktop. I think for a lot of people, the far corners might be a little problematic. But, you know, this is also not a monitor that a ton of people are going to buy because it's it's like list for $1,699. It's currently on sale for $1,349. It's interesting. It's an interesting panel. It's a big box.
You know, I was thinking about this, the curvature, like you said, this is less aggressively curved than some monitors, but that works because this is IPS, so you already have really good viewing angle
Yeah.
So you don't have to surround your, like a screen this big, you'd almost have to just wrap it around you with VA to not have a color shift that was visible to you. So, I mean, I could see getting a monitor like this. And yes, it's expensive, but I could replace two monitors on my desk with this and do side by side, like full unencumbered, like dual monitor type setups, but just within the same screen.
Yeah. I think that's really for a lot of people. You know, if you're sitting at a desk, you know, if you want to do just sort of like two inputs side by side and sort of slide between them on your desk, or if you're currently running multiple monitors, this is definitely a viable replacement for multiple monitors. I just think you might be configuring your stuff on the screen a little bit differently based on this. Because are you currently running, do you run them sort of, you know, side by side, or do you actually have the monitors on your desktop angled towards you?
When I run dual monitor, I basically do that. Like I have them both angled where I'm basically simulating a curve.
Sure.
So that's where I look at something like this. Like honestly, this would replace two like smaller monitors, like 25 inch, I think is the ultra sharp I usually use. And, you know, you get two of those with like one of those dual arm mounts and have them side by side. Like once you've bought two monitors and bought the fancy desk mount to have them side by side and angled and everything, then you're spending $1,000 plus anyway. So this is
nice to have it has a VESA mount on the back. It's a 52 pound monitor, give or take. You know,
52 pounds. What is it made out of? I thought these were like plastic.
Well, you know, that's 52 pounds with the base. One, there's a very big inside that box. The monitor is about 6 or 8 inches smaller than that box.
Okay.
You know, running, you know, up, you know, looking at the longest dimension on that box. So there's several inches of packaging around the monitor. But
and
it's
for
a big piece of glass.
Audio listeners, by the way, I will add that this near the box in the image that we're looking at comes very close to your shoulder.
Yeah.
This is a very, very large monitor.
Yeah, I got it set up by myself. I think most normal human beings would want a second person in the room with them. A lot of the weight, I think, is actually the base of the monitor, which is, you know, dense.
Cast iron, probably. Lead? Well, not lead.
Yeah, probably not lead. lead would be very practical from a physics standpoint because density. But I think there's a big old chunk of steel at the very base of that monitor just to make it less susceptible to being tipped over. And I got to say, they did a really good job of, you know, balancing that thing and getting the center of gravity on it low enough so that I wasn't worried about one of my kids, you know, poking it at one end and having it tip over or anything. It is a big monitor. I'm also looking at like, yes, 7,372,000 pixels inside that thing. So, you know, it's not quite as bad as, actually, it's pretty much a 4K monitor in terms of pixel count. I was going to say, because a 4K monitor would be like 829,000. So, yeah, you know, treat it like a 4K monitor. With a really, really unusual scale on that one. So,
yeah, 4K monitor, 8.3-ish million pixels. So you're getting close.
Yeah. 8,294,400.
I mean, 8.3 million is pretty close.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're speccing out a GPU for something like that, think 4K. I liked it. I don't think, you know, you have to be a really hardcore sort of multiple monitor user, I think, to deal with this giant thing. And it's an ultra sharp, so the glass looked really, really good, which is always a plus. Did you see, speaking of excess and joy and color, did you see Thermaltake's booth at CES, their room?
No, I did not. I was only there for like 2 full days. I missed a bunch of meetings that my associate was attending, so I did not get to see Thermaltake. I haven't been to Thermaltake in a couple of years, actually, but they always have one of the best looking suites. I remember it's like RGB everywhere and like these huge decked out computer builds with custom liquid cooling and everything. So this product, that I'm sure you're segueing into is right up their alley. Like, this is, it's totally ridiculous. It's totally excessive, and it's awesome at the same time.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, pretty much, like, you know, go to kickguru.net, you know, read about it. But I was walking to another meeting, and I saw, first of all, I saw a Thermaltek sign, and then I saw some amazing custom machines they had built in there. And then I saw this crazy, you know, it's, they call it water RAM, right? They got a 16 and a 32 gigabyte version of this. It's a DDR4 running at 3200 megahertz, and it's a big water block that wraps around your RAM, because what can be more terrifying than putting liquid cooling inside of your computer attached to your GPU and your CPU? You can throw in cooling for memory too. So it ends up looking like a block, a plastic brick full of light on top of your the dual module 16 gigabyte kit or quad module 32 gigabyte kit. Yes, there's RGB lighting, and you can run them. My understanding is you can actually run them without the heat pump or without it water cycling through them, should you want to. I just thought this was fascinating.
Because I've done some memory overclocking, like you run into some heat when you really start increasing voltage to get your overclock stable. So I want to know what the headroom on these is. Like, did they really, really push these things? I mean, we've seen DDR4 speeds obviously way above 3200 megahertz at this point. So I believe the KitGuru review said this was like SK Hynix memory. This says similar to the G-Skill Trident Z set, the RGB DDR4 3200 set. So the timings are pretty good already. Like, this is 16 CAS memory, like 16, 18, 18, 38, with the XMP profile. So I just wonder if you bump up the voltage, what you could do on liquid, because they were seeing improvements to temperature just because the block is on there,
right?
But once you actually put it underwater, it was dropping down to basically ambient temperature. So
yeah, it was I don't know. It's at this point, I think we're going to wait to see who adopts this and what they do with it. I was just so excited to see it. Somebody had actually assembled it at this point.
You know, I saw at, I think it was FSP, liquid cooled and overclockable power supplies. That was one of my favorite things at CES, just because it's just like over the top. Like, it's not just a liquid-cooled power supply. It's an overclockable power supply. If it's under water, you can actually increase the power because, you know, the way that these things are rated, it's like a certain wattage at a certain temperature, and then you could, like, oh, but my 850 is now 1,000 watts because it's underwater. So I want a system where, you know, the VRMs on my motherboard, all of that are liquid cooled. There are motherboards out there that have that all pre-installed. Liquid cooled memory, liquid cooled graphics and CPU, liquid cooled power supply. I mean, I guess, like, at that point you might as well just put the whole thing in mineral oil, but I mean,
no, I've done that. You don't.
Oh, okay.
no, in my personal experience, I think mineral oil in many ways is a better insulator than it is conductor of heat because of the realities of not having pumps that will move mineral oil effectively, but component failure, and if you have to change anything or tweak anything that involves physically touching the hardware, there are a few things in life more disgusting than what you get when you pull a computer out of an oil bath. It's just bad. It looks really good when R2-D2 does it on Tatooine.
Yeah.
Never works out that well in real life. So, oh my goodness. Speaking of excess and mayhem, Modders Inc. Got a Synology DS1819 Plus. And this is pretty crazy. Synology provided the hardware. That part's not crazy. But I was looking at this story and just blinking, because you can buy 10 terabyte WD Red. You can buy 14 terabyte Seagate drives. But the numbers on this was they managed to take an 8-bay device and get 242 terabytes into it. Were they using a single 8-bay device?
That's with an external unit. There is a 10-bay expansion unit for this. That's one of the things about this. Like this is already expensive. This is a $1,000 NAS. So it's
right.
You're getting into that like SAN kind of territory with this.
Yeah.
But it has 8 drive bays which support up to 14 terabyte drives, you know, so by 8, that's 112 terabytes. You can go up to 252 terabytes using this if you buy their optional 10 bay expansion unit. And the other interesting thing about this that you can get, because it has a PCI Express slot and they offer a 10 gig expansion card. So then you can put this on like a very, you know, high speed network as well. Although right out of the box, it has four. I have not seen this personally. So this has 4 gigabit ports, which support link aggregation.
Yeah, so that's
quadruple the bandwidth.
Yeah, that doesn't really work that way, but that we can have a conversation. I'm actually running a bunch of benchmarks on link aggregation, which is different than it would be in the professional space.
Well, plus you have to have equipment through the chain that supports it, or you have to virtualize support for it, I guess.
It's what's interesting about that is it's really hard to get actual devices that do link aggregation at consumer prices, like real link aggregation. So what most people using something like this end up, what it will do is it will split. If you have multiple devices connected to the NAS, it will give each one of those its own Ethernet port.
Okay.
Because, you know, actual link aggregation, and I don't want to screw the terminology up, because it's something I've researched thoroughly, because I was trying to do some link aggregation. Then I literally could not buy the hardware I needed without spending staggering amounts of money, because a lot of stuff that just supports link aggregation doesn't actually support it the way that consumer networking manufacturers seem to have a different definition of link aggregation and what it means and how it works than NAS.
It almost sounds like you're describing 5G, like, back when we were doing like LTE, where everybody had their own idea of like what the next gen was going to be. Like, is it carrier aggregation to get us the additional bandwidth? And like everybody had their own, you know, like it was going to be microcell, like blanketing Wi-Fi, carrier aggregation, et cetera, et cetera. So
it's not quite that crazy making, but it is frustrating, because you start to realize, you know, if you're not running with some fairly high end, you know, professional, maybe not, you know, enterprise, but small business stuff, it will not run the way you think it's supposed to run, which actually I don't think is a problem for most consumer environments. If you're streaming 4K to a television and occasionally backing up data, or you're running your entire audio collection off of this, you're not hitting a lot of bandwidth and it's not a problem. If you're trying to do more demanding stuff, it gets more exciting and you're going to be spending a lot more than you probably thought for certain kinds of hardware support. But it's interesting, because you very rarely see, there's SmallNet Builder that does some really amazing router and NAS testing, and they're one of the only operations out there that do super in-depth testing of this stuff. I think it's maybe the only time I've ever seen somebody report on what it was like to stack, you know, the multiple Synology boxes, because they make them, they continue to make them, so they sell them. But this is, you know, I've got 18 terabytes in one NAS in there. If I upgrade my 6-bay NAS to 6-bay drives, I'll have approximately 30 terabytes accessible on that one. That's their RAID calculator. You just start dragging drives down onto that one. And that's why I was like, because I was double checking. I'm like, wait a minute, I don't think the math works on this. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. I was thrown too. I'm like, how is this possible? With 14 terabyte drives, which is, you know, it's crazy that we have 14 terabyte drives.
Yeah. And I was wondering, like, are they using some sort of crazy thing we haven't heard about on the enterprise level? And I'm like, no.
It's all in the cloud, Patrick. It's 252 terabytes of cloud backup in a single bay NAS. You know, I'm sure that'll be a thing.
I'm just going to put the entire contents of the internet there. So it's, I don't know. It's interesting to look at the performance, and it's interesting to look at some of the specs and where things hang up performance-wise versus where things look particularly shiny in the specs for NAS boxes. That's something that's kind of been rattling inside of my skull. I'm also moving a lot of more stuff onto a NAS and away from a computer just to see how it performs as I load more and more things into its life, which it doesn't seem to be too upset about, but you know,
I do not envy any network testing. So,
you and I can have a wonderful offline conversation about that.
Yeah,
because I've done a lot of it, and my network closet, as a result, my media and network closet looks like the spaghetti monster vomited into it. And I will say, network performance testing is one of the most frustrating things I think I've ever done, to the point where some of the people I know that are doing really amazing work on that are either A, using enterprise testing equipment that costs tens of thousands, or have scripted entire systems to simulate a normal household load. But I digress. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Helm. Helm believes you have the right to live on your own terms, including online, right? It's kind of crazy. They created a personal server that allows you to easily own and manage your online identity, starting with your email, your calendars, and contacts. If you've ever gotten a little thinking about the fact that Google pretty much knows everything, think about this. Your most critical data, emails, contacts, calendar details, and more, stored on massive corporate servers outside your home. So many things have been hacked. So many things have been surveilled. You never really know. You know, the fact is we don't really know what the United States government is looking at. You don't know what foreign governments are looking at. And you might be a little uptight about that. If you connect Helm to your home network, their goal is to give you uncompromising personal data, privacy, and security. They want you to feel safe and secure online. Wherever you are in the world, knowing your data is not in the cloud, but actually stored with you. Free from the threat of hacking, corporate data aggregation, and government surveillance. Okay, anything can be hacked, but they're working pretty hard on this. And, you know, your house is probably not going to be as big a target as Google's house. It's easy to set up. You can access it from anywhere in the world. You know, they're rolling with DMARC, SFP, and DKIM, email authentication, 128 gigabytes of solid-state storage, which doesn't sound like a lot, but A, solid-state is fast, and B, your email doesn't take up, you know, HD video space. Full disk encryption. The keys are managed by a secure enclave. You are the only person with the key to the kingdom. Secure boot. Server-to-server encryption over TLS with certificates from Let's Encrypt. They got proximity-based two-factor authentication through the Helm app. They've done a lot of stuff to make it enormously difficult to get at your information. Helm's private by default. They design it with a VPN tunnel. They have encrypted offsite backups that are only accessible to you and only with a unique private security key. They're doing some good stuff here. And free shipping, a one-year warranty, and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Privacy is a right, not a setting. Protect what matters with Helm. For a limited time, save $50 off the Helm personal server by visiting thehelm.com/twitch. But don't wait. This offer is only valid for a limited time. That's thehelm.com/twitch. And we want to thank Helm for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. It's a cool box. It really is. So we haven't talked. I feel like there hasn't been a lot of phone news lately.
yeah, I mean, we've been seeing all the leaks and for Galaxy, of course, the S10. But yeah.
Mobile World, you know, Congress.
We've basically seen the whole phone at this point.
Yeah. You know, we won't have it confirmed for a while, but kind of out of the blue this morning, Motorola dropped all the deets on the G7 line, their mid-range phone, their entry-level phones. I personally carry a G6, so this may be of more interest to me than it is to most people. But the idea is you're getting a lot of phone for the third of a price of a flagship. The naming is familiar, the G7, the G7 Plus, the G7 Power, the G7 Play, with just enough differences in availability and how they are kitted out to be really confusing. But they all have headphone jacks still. Prices are up about 20% overall, which I have been told it can be pretty much laid at the feet at the cost of components, and they're just getting more expensive. The regular G7, you're looking at a 6.2-inch 2270 by 1080 slim bezel LCD. Ends up being about 403 pixels per inch, which is easy on the eye. It's got a pair dual 12 megapixel cameras, 8 megapixel selfie camera, 64 gigabytes of storage, a 3000 milliamp hour battery. I love the fact that they're starting with 64 gigabytes of storage and that it has 4 gigabytes of memory. So that was one of the pain points on the G6, was you could get it with 3 gigabytes in the United States, and they had sort of an upgraded version. Like 3 gigabytes and 32 gigabytes of RAM, or 32 gigabytes of storage. And then outside of the United States, or through this really weird Amazon purchase opportunity, you could get a 6 gigabyte / 64 gigabyte version. So 8-core Snapdragon 632, which is funny because if you look at people that write a lot about flagships, they're like, the mediocre mid-level Snapdragon 632. But I got to be honest with you, my one performance issue with this phone is the click-to-clunk time when you go to take a picture. But in every other thing I do with the phone, the mid-level Snapdragons are pretty freaking fast compared to any tasks I throw at them. So that's going to be $299. It's on sale in Brazil and Mexico today. It's coming to Europe and the United States later this spring. And again, that's $50 more than the MSRP of the current G6. So the prices have scaled up. $249 gets you the G7 Power, which is running a 5,000 milliamp hour battery. And the G7 Play is still the cheapest at $199. It doesn't have the slick dual cameras. It's got a smaller 5.7-inch screen. And then there's also, if you are listening outside of the United States, keep an eye out for the Plus, which was like €300 / $340 US, which gets you like a 16 megapixel dual camera, optical image stabilization, and some other slick features. And that also went on sale in Brazil and Mexico today. So
you talked about camera performance with your G6. What's image quality like? Like, maybe it's a little slow, but I mean, is it like
good.
A relatively clean image? Is it?
It's a very bad time to ask me this question because, I bought a Sony A6000 heading into CES because I need to do a bunch more video at CES this year. And I needed really, really good low light performance. I didn't want to have to be using my phone to take video. So right now, I've been shooting a bunch, especially with my boys. They were out riding scooters up front. And the low light performance in this dimly lit street with, I've got this vacuum, light vacuum of a lens on the camera right now. The sensor is really, really good. The lens is really, really good. So I'm taking amazing photos. So I feel like it is kind of cruel to compare this to what I've been looking at. Or I should say, this actually is pretty good, but it looks like trash compared to the stuff coming out of the A6000. The click to clunk time, like I want to say, I went from an iPhone 6S to the G6. And in terms of if there's light, if you have decent lighting, if you're not dealing with, sort of speed-related focusing issues, it's great. I will say the first time I played around with an Android phone for a really long period of time was the last time I trashed an iPhone 1,000 years ago. The G4 I had, the camera was just unacceptable, really bad. Is this camera in this, $249 phone as good as a flagship phone? No. And it's considerably worse in low light performance. But if you have steady hands and you mostly have a decent amount of light, it does a fine job. Is it as good as anything in the top of the line Google Pixel phone or Samsung phone or iPhone? No. But that's also why I want a dedicated camera.
The last time I used a Moto, I think I bought the first generation Moto G.
Right.
And I got the Moto E just because it was $100 and I wanted to try it out. But I was so impressed with, and that was, I think, when Google still owned Motorola. So
Right.
I don't know if anything's changed as far as build quality goes. The screens were pretty good. They were not as colorful, like not as rich looking. Mm-hmm. But there was reasonable pixel density even then, and those were like 1280 by 720, I think, at the low end at the time. But we've gotten to the point now where these like budget-conscious phones have high pixel density,
mm-hmm.
probably much improved camera sensors. That was one of the issues with the other phones. Budget phones, you know, in 2014, 15 were pretty terrible. I mean, I don't think anything's ever been worse than my Nexus 4 that had an absolutely atrocious camera. I wanted to love it,
right.
And I loved that phone, but I mean, that was kind of like the beginning of Android for me. I had switched from an iPhone to a Nexus 4 at that time, and I've gone back and forth and back and forth. And one of the things about iPhones to me is that they are actually a little slow. You called it the click and clunk time, like the actual time it takes from when you, you know, actuate the virtual shutter to when it takes the picture is a little slower than it is on, say, a Samsung phone. And Samsung, it's like their whole photography philosophy is make these photos as like the shutter speed is absolutely outrageous. The
right.
ISO is pumped up to, you know, ungodly numbers, and then they do this exposure compensation and boost that's automatic. Like as you take the photo, it's like as soon as you touch the button, it's taking the photo, and then it's like it momentarily processes it, and then you have something that is like twice as bright as the available light that you just shot with. Mm-hmm. So no way to defeat this unless you go into like automatic or manual settings. But automatic settings on Samsung Galaxy phones, I've been playing around with the S9 Plus off and on for the last few months, and it doesn't matter where I am or what kind of brightness level I have, it's like blown out brightness with every shot. So iPhone, more realistic, it's more like what your eye is seeing, but it's a little bit slower.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as I see that one of the specs of this new phone is the PDAF, so we'll have to see what kind of improvements they get with enhanced like focus abilities and like low light. So
makes you think. It does. Yeah, I will say, as tempting as a flagship phone is, and there are moments which I wish had like the camera out of the Google Pixel 3 or the iPhone XR, 98% of the time I'm not too frustrated with it. Love that video. Yeah, 4K recording.
Plus, you're not spending, you know, $750 to $1,000 or more out of pocket on a device.
That'll probably break.
If you have an active lifestyle.
With careful case shopping and tempered glass covers, it's been a long time since I broke a screen. So I think I figured out the formula for armoring my phones, which make them look considerably less svelte than they started out with. But I'll take less svelte over shards of glass in my fingertips, which is just sounds even worse than it is. And it's painful. I thought this was interesting. I just want to one quick story before we go. I did not realize that Google Fiber was wiring Louisville. And things have hit a snag, pun or no pun intended. But they were doing a new, they're calling it shallow trenching. So if you've ever watched fiber or any other kind of cable get pulled, it normally involves digging a very, very deep trench. And so that you don't have to worry about, say, somebody digging for their garden and cutting fiber in half for the community. And this is, they were talking about, and some crazy numbers, they were going to, you know, roll out gigabit internet in Louisville in 5 months. And instead of feet, we're talking about inches below the ground. And that's pretty huge, right? Because Google had kind of checked out in 2016. The numbers weren't working. And they did their reset fired the CEO, stopped future deployments. And, you know, the shallow trenching is also called micro trenching or nano trenching. And so this does not seem to have worked. And I'm not seeing a whole lot of detail on this, and I don't know whether it was so shallow that it was getting broken or if the cable rollout wasn't working.
Well, apparently it was popping out of these shallow trenches. Like, it was just... I mean,
the number I saw was 2 inches
than me, but it still gets kind of cold in the winter. I can't imagine dealing with regular asphalt roads that you put it that close to the surface where you're going to have potholes, you're going to have cracks. You're putting this like 3 inches below the surface of the road and then just putting like, you know, patching over it with tar. It's not going to stay down.
Well, when you read about laying cable across oceans, the whole kind of the tension on the cable, how fast you lay the cable out, the amount of slack that's in the cable, you know, there's like all the brains, like all the intellectual property in that is basically on how much tension is on the cable and how long it is. And just to get the cable to not snap when you're talking about the forces it takes or the forces that act on a cable that's going across the ocean. And if you look at the webpage on CNET, you know, it's crazy to look at how they have this laid out where there is, yeah, I've heard that these trenches are like 2 inches deep. So they're basically like big saw kerfs into the asphalt. They're filling it with, you know, what looks like a tar-like or epoxy-like substance. So, bummer. Because I am always hoping for more competition in the world of the internet or providing it, ISPs. But it does not look like it has worked out in this latest iteration of Google Fiber.
So. I can't believe they even thought it was going to work. Looking at these pictures, like, it just seems crazy to me. Like, this would have worked for a few months, but then you would have had some sort of environmental issue. Like, nature happens. We should probably prepare for it, because putting cables 2 inches below the ground. Now, of course, if they go 6 inches deep, that, you know, it says micro trenching is what they've switched to, which uses a similar technique but goes at least 6 inches. Like, I really don't think 6 inches below asphalt in the middle of a road is still sufficient. But hey, I'm not an engineer.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. If you are new to the podcast, you're listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. We call it Twitch. You can find all of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe over at twit.tv/TWICH. That's twit.tv/Twitch. And we want to thank each and every one of you for listening. If I'm new to you, my name is Patrick Norton. You can find more of me over at TechThing, TechThing.com, or at AVXL. And ladies and gentlemen, Sebastian Peake can be found over at PC Purr. And if you haven't, head on over there and read his full review of the AMD Radeon 7, because there is much to learn, people. With that, ladies and gentlemen.
Pour over all the charts.
In minute detail, all of the information. Oh, my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Sebastian Peake.
I'll catch you next week on Twitch.